Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Experience the wonder of summer. Have a month's payment on Volvo and spend your summer doing the things that matter to you. Plus, get up to 5 years full coverage, including wear and tear. Go to volvocars.com/us.
This podcast contains explicit language.
No Republican.
I can't hear Adriana. Should I be able to?
I can.
Now I can.
Yes.
I just wanted to make... I just wanted you to know.
Arthur, she was really making fun of your haircut.
Oh, really? Did it myself.
So that happened. Bernie Sanders is the hottest ticket in the 2016 race, drawing crowds that dwarf everyone else. Will his new criminal justice platform satisfy Black Lives Matter activists who are protesting not only Sanders, but Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush? Then we'll talk to dangerous ne'er-do-wells Ryan Riley and Wesley Lowery about their nefarious activities in Ferguson, Missouri. We'll also talk to famous Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, who wants to run for president, even though he doesn't actually want to be president. Don't worry, we'll explain. And don't forget, Donald Trump is running for president, which is still hilarious and terrible and awesome. I'm Zach Carter, joined by Huffington Post reporters Arthur Delaney, Julia Craven, and Ryan Riley. And here's what happened first. All right, so I think Bernie Sanders has probably had the craziest week of any 73-year-old I know. He's got some great poll numbers from New Hampshire, showing him with a lead over Hillary Clinton. He's been drawing huge crowds in on the West Coast, in Portland and Seattle. But I think the event that really jumped out, certainly to people in the progressive movement, I think to the country more broadly, was a protest of one of a rally that he was scheduled to speak at in Seattle. And joining me now to talk about it, we have HuffPost's own Julia Craven.
Hi.
And Gerald Hankerson, the NAACP president from Seattle, King County, who was actually present at the rally and spoke at the rally. Thanks for joining us, Gerald.
Thank you for having me.
So, Gerald, since you were there, I just kind of want to get just ask you to recount what the event was like and what happened and what you thought was significant about it.
Yeah, well, obviously, we were there for Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare rally celebrating its birthday after 60 years of a program that a lot of our people, particularly African-American people, solely depend on as their only source of income. And a lot of coalition folks was there that put it together. And, of course, Bernie Sanders was invited to participate as well. And for the first part of the program, it went perfectly well as far as talking about the issues for which we were there. And I did speak as the first speaker talking about the very issue, how Social Security impacts our community and why we need to expand it. And at the end of the program, Bernie Sanders took the stage, two young women from the Black Lives Matter movement interrupted the program and took over the stage and took over that moment and seized their space. And there was a lot of different disruption. People were going crazy because they was there to be Bernie. But overall, after the end of the day, the one significant thing that I learned about the incident that took place is the true nature of some of the conversations and some of the statements that was being yelled by the folks that was there to hear Bernie that I found to be troubling. It really, for me, exposed the true nature and true feelings that when it comes to progressive and liberals, they still said some of the most horrible things. And those are the specific things that got exposed to me. The Bernie followers, notwithstanding the fact that obviously he identifies with a lot of our issues, but when it comes to race, he clearly was failed, and they exposed that. And not only did they expose that for Bernie Sanders, but it did reveal the true feelings that folks in Seattle, how they truly feel when it comes to race. And that was the most difficult part for me, but ultimately, the best lesson I learned from that day.
So I thought this really exposed a sort of longstanding rift in the progressive movement that a lot of progressives, certainly white progressives, don't usually like to talk about, which is when you – when you look at the progressive movement and say, like, a lot of the events that I go to or the jobs I've had, for instance, there was a protest at Netroots earlier this year. And I remember one of the protesters talked to Jamil Smith from the New Republic afterwards and said, you know, when I go to Netroots, I see a lot of white progressives. I don't see them talking about things I care about. And I remember thinking, yeah, when I go to Netroots, it is kind of like that. But when you see people yelling, arrest her and throwing water bottles at the stage, I think it does show how there's just because people want to be on Team Justice doesn't mean they are. Julia, there has been this longstanding split. Not only that, sometimes white progressives are kind of racist, but there's also in the way that people talk about, approach social justice issues. So Gerald's just talking about economic policies that tend to disproportionately help people of color because people of color tend to disproportionately be economically screwed over. The Black Lives Matter movement has a lot of activists who don't like that frame. They prefer to talk directly about race and particularly about criminal justice and violence. Do you think that frame on sort of racial theory and racial progress is gaining more ground right now, is more dominant in the activist culture?
I think it is. I think that we have a tendency to focus on, like, criminal justice reform, mass incarceration, et cetera, when, honestly, one of the things that we really do need to think about are these middle-class economic policies, because they don't affect different racial groups the same way. So that's kind of why I like the targeting, for lack of a better word, of, like, the Democratic candidates, because they get their votes, specifically the Black vote, based on, like, their middle-class economic policies. But it's like these policies have never really helped Black people get out of poverty or attain wealth.
One of the protesters, named Marissa Janae Johnson, who's on the stage, we invited her to be part of the show. Didn't hear from her. I'm sure she's pretty busy right now. But one of the things that's interesting, though, I looked at some of the polling on the stuff from Gallup. They do a poll which just shows it's open ended. So they ask you what's the most important issue facing the country today, and they break it out by race, economic stuff for Black voters tends to take the cake. The two number one things that are tied are unemployment and jobs, which is tied with race relations at 13%. But then number two is economy in general, and like number three or four is poverty, and then healthcare. It all seem like economic issues. Gerald Hankerson, do you think there are ways that white progressives who want to be part of the racial justice movement can learn to talk about economic policies and not piss people off?
Yeah. First of all, I think the misconception is the reality that, particularly folks in our community, feels racial economic inequality is not the same as racial inequality. Obviously, some of it overlaps, but most importantly for people of our community, racial inequality is more important, because addressing race addresses all other elements when it comes to whatever economic policy. Remember, this conversation for several hundred years ago, the slave trade was of economic policy, not as far as a race policy. We actually feel like this is the same conversation happening again today. When we're talking about Black issues, we can't wrap it around as just talking about economic policies, as addressing those, as solving the back problem. That's not the case. And just picking up one particular institution like criminal justice reform and other reforms, race impacts a lot of different institutions, that is institutional racism, not just criminal justice reform. So when progressives feel like they're addressing our policy when they talk about it from an economic standpoint, they miss the point. Because race, it matters. Black lives matter first, and then understanding that concept will again allow you to address racial inequality in all institutions, not just one or two that's most impacting us.
How did you feel about, what did you think about the way Bernie Sanders himself responded to the protest?
Well, the fact that he had the opportunity that he could have addressed this and talk about it in a way to where he could, obviously our community feels strongly about Bernie Sanders, because some of them actually feel that he's the best candidate. But his inability to talk about race in this day and in this era is problematic. I don't think that people actually is upset about Bernie's policy when it comes to economic inequality, but when it comes to race, his failure to do so, this is where he struggled. And he has a great opportunity right now to address it in a way to bring bring in the youth, the youth, the folks that's in this new era, this new activism. Understanding the Black Lives Matter movement also requires to understand the Civil Rights Movement. The inability to understand those two kind of explain why people just don't understand what's going on here. But most importantly, I'm not, I don't condone nor condemn how those activists, their tactics, because this has been a cornerstone of activism as long as I've been around. Getting attention, agitation, all those stuff, because people are still dying in the street, and there seems to be no one is willing to talk about it in a way to where it's really going to get to the heart of what's impacting our communities. They like to sugarcoat it, like the progressives do, and pretend like it's not there, but right below the surface, their inability to talk about race in a real way is where the problem's at. I call it passive aggressiveness, if you ask me.
So, Julia, to what extent do you think this is a communication problem? Were there people who are just talking past each other? To what extent do you think this is a fundamental difference within the progressive movement about how things are and how they ought to be?
I don't really think it's that big of a communication problem. I think that it just does boil down to fundamental differences, because it's kind of like a lot of white progressives, they think that because they're not individually racist, that therefore, you know, it's not... How do I say this? They think that because they're not individually racist, that they're not benefiting from certain systems mm-hmm. that perpetuate racism. So, yeah, I think it just really boils down to that, honestly.
And what did you think of, so Bernie Sanders did release a pretty lengthy criminal justice reform set of proposals. What did you make of those proposals? This was after the protest, of course.
He has some strong language in there. mm-hmm. But again, it's really difficult for me to like trust stuff like that. Just because a lot of candidates, including Barack Obama, you know, they talk one way and then they walk another. So
Gerald Hankerson, that distrust of politicians in general, Marissa Janae Johnson's not here, but when she gave an interview to another podcast, she said, you know, I don't think the electoral process works at all. I mean, it seemed like her perspective, it wasn't just like Bernie Sanders talks about this stuff poorly or something. It was, I don't think electoral politics are a good idea. I don't think she would have been happy with the criminal justice reform proposals that Bernie put out. I mean, she's actually calling for the abolition of police forces, which is not, I mean, she's not going to get that from any candidate that's running for president, I don't think. Gerald Hankerson, are there a set of policies that you see as you know, predominantly, like overwhelmingly important on criminal justice reform that candidates need to be talking about?
Well, obviously, true, absolutely. One of the biggest ones right now is police accountability. One of the biggest things that's going on in our country right now, where a lot of our young men and women is being killed around the country at the hands of police. And as we continue to have this debate, it's continuing to happen. No one is coming up with a strategy or plan to address this crisis, as I call it. So that's one of the key areas there. And I sort of agree with the fact of, Bernie Sanders want to talk about criminal justice reform. But if it took this kind of efforts and actions and direct actions just to get him to be able to talk about it, imagine the distrust that if he were to win the election for the president, that we don't trust the fact he's going to do anything about it. So he really got to come across in a strong and convincing way that not only am I willing to talk about it, I promise you I'm going to do something about it if I do win the presidency, which is exactly what the fact that the Black Lives Matter movements portrayed. Talking about it is key, but part of us feel like that his inability to talk about it was beyond. You know, when you got a huge white crowd, you don't see a whole lot of people of color in his big, huge crowds he's been gathering, which is exactly the point, and which is why some people feel like the Electoral College really doesn't work, because the people that are going to be dominating at the polls is the people that outnumber us when it comes to white progressives. So I totally agree that the progressives automatically feel like they are entitled to our support because they've been a part of the things we've been doing for so long. But now that we're here, it feels like they've actually forgot about us to talk about race on its face, and that has created the problem between the separation between our communities as well as our politics.
So what about the other candidates? Because this protest was pretty intense. It was beyond confrontational. I mean, at times I thought the speakers were pretty hostile to the audience, and the audience was hostile right back. But Hillary Clinton, by contrast, locks out Black Lives Matter protesters from her from her event, and gets a quiet, private, you know, off the record meeting with protesters. Jeb Bush was confronted this week as well, and Jeb Bush he got a chant, and someone was escorted from the yeah. meeting, and then I think someone got to ask some questions at the end. And, you know, I don't think Jeb Bush had a good time at that event, but is the level of attention paid to Bernie appropriate relative to the other candidates, you think, Julia?
Well, one, I think Bernie's easier to get to. It's tough to get to Clinton because she has Secret Service, so it's really hard to get to her. And then another thing that I think about her is I think that the fact that she is harder to get to is what's playing a role in this, because Black people have not forgotten about the crime bill. Mm-hmm. Like, that's still very much an issue. And she's walked back on that. She's just like, oh, well, you know, I realized that promoting the crime bill was a big mistake. But it's just kind of like she hasn't offered any, like, policy suggestions as to what she's going to do to reverse that. So I think that she's a target, because, like, she pretty much, or her husband rather, pushed mass incarceration. So
and she defended tough on crime policies as late as the 2008 election.
Right.
But, you know, her approval rating among Black voters is still it's like 80%. I think Bernie Sanders is 23%. His disapproval rating is only 10%. Hers is 12. But like 92% of Black voters know who Hillary Clinton is. Only about a third of them know who Bernie Sanders is. Gerald Hankerson, do you think there's a disconnect between the way activist voters think about Hillary Clinton and the way the public at large thinks about her?
I definitely agree with that. Obviously, you know, as you just heard, that Hillary Clinton, when she and her and her husband was in the White House, they were responsible for building the most prisons that were, you know, led to this mass incarceration, particularly when it comes to people of color that filled up our prisons. So she definitely has some work to do on convincing of that. And as Bernie Sanders has said, that he won't come out talking about it in a way, because he feels that the candidate Clinton obviously is a panderer. So she'll say whatever she needs to say to a communities of color to particularly get their vote. So he's feeling pretty stubborn about that. But overall, folks looking for Bernie Sanders to give them a reason to why they should leave one campaign to join the rest. He hit on every point that everything in our community feels strongly about, particularly when it comes to economic policies, getting jobs, and the unemployment rate, when it comes to our community, criminal justice reform, all those areas. But when specifically talking about race, there's no candidate talking about that, which is the reason why the Black Lives Matter movement, the young activists, have generated this kind of bubbled up and talk about it in a way to not only see the need to talk about it, but also for all the supporters of the Sanders and the Klan campaign to understand that Black Lives Matter. Until we talk about it, all the candidates are going to be filling this heat up until Election Day.
All right. Well, Gerald Hankerson, thanks so much for joining us. And Julia, you'll be back later in the show. For now, we'll see you guys in just a minute.
This podcast is sponsored by Volvo. It's time to experience the wonder of summer. Leave early, get close, wander more, stargaze, do it all. Have a month's payment on Volvo and spend your summer doing the things that matter to you. Plus, get up to 5 years full coverage, including wear and tear. The Wonder of Summer event from Volvo. Go to volvocars.com/us or test drive a Volvo at your local dealer.
And we're back. So we are joined now by Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, who is, I think, most famous for a lot of work on copyright and free speech. But he's been working on a lot of political justice issues, political corruption issues lately. Professor Lessig, you are interested in a run for president. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And because I'm now thinking of political things, I'm told I have to be referred to as Larry now. So it's not Professor Lessig anymore. It's not Lawrence.
Oh, is your brand is Larry?
No, now it's got to be Larry, right? Well, the Bernie, Larry, Hillary show.
Feel the Larry. Okay, so you're running for president, but let me get this straight. You don't actually want to be president?
No, I want to be a president who can make it possible for the next great president to actually be able to do something. And what I figured is the only way to do that is to be, you know, kind of like Frodo Baggins, like somebody who grabs the ring to throw it into the in the mountain and make it so that the power no longer corrupts.
What is the ring?
The ring is this incredibly corrupted system that we've evolved in our government for representing the people. You know, this system where this tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% funds the campaigns makes it impossible for us to address any important issues sensibly. So, you know, when you think about all the issues the Democratic candidates are talking about that they're going to be dealing with, all these great ideas, bold ideas from climate change to student debt, you know, what we know is that none of those can be solved given this corrupt system until we find a way to fix that corrupt system. So that's the idea. Elizabeth Warren tells me the system is rigged. I agree with her. The system is rigged. So we have to unrig the rigged systems first.
Larry Lessig, the sense I have is that you have a lot of policy agreement with Senator Bernie Sanders, who is a major candidate at this point, but you've got a much stronger emphasis on what you're talking about, corruption and campaign finance reform. Is that a way people could understand how you fit into this very crowded race right now?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a difference in degree. I think it's a difference in kind. Certainly Bernie has increasingly checks off the right boxes when it comes to this corruption issue. And I admire him. I've admired him for as long as I've known anything about politics. He's extraordinary. But the problem is, you know, he's listing this corruption stuff as one of seven different issues, one of eight issues, right? You know, when we launched our campaign, it was literally issue number eight. The day we launched, it moved to issue number two, so that's progress. But still, it's like one of eight. This is the most powerful interest in Washington that we have to take on to win this issue. So if you come to Washington with, you know, one of eight issues defining your mandate to take on this most powerful force against reform, you can't do it. So what I said to him, and his campaign apparently leaked this to Politico, what I said to him in the early stages of his campaign was, you've got to convince us that you can fix this first. And if you can convince us you can fix it first, then everything else you say is credible. But if you can't show us you're going to fix it first, then what you're talking about when you talk about all these, you know, bold ideas is just not credible.
Let me jump in there, Larry. I keep wanting to call you professor because you said before the campaign finance system, right? Larry. So the ring is the corrupt campaign finance system. What is Mount Doom for you? What is the thing that you throw the campaign finance system into?
Reform. And so when it's melted in the volcano, what it turns into is a system where we have exactly what we had at the time the framers thought they gave us, a representative democracy, a system where every citizen is equal. Now, of course, they were pretty oblivious to this, to the citizens who should be equal. Like, they didn't think much about blacks being citizens. They didn't think women should be equal. So I'm not, you know, praising their insights about equality on all dimensions. But the one thing they got was that if you were a citizen, you were supposed to have equal status in the republic. And by corrupting that, what we've done is create a system where a tiny, tiny fraction have extraordinary power in our democracy.
But what is the mechanism for changing that?
So if we change that by, for example, changing the way campaigns are funded, imagine instead of, you know, 400 families giving half the amount of money that's been raised in this campaign cycle so far, every voter had a $50 or $100 voucher, which they could use to give the candidates to fund their campaigns. All of a sudden, candidates would be focused on the millions to fund their campaigns, not on the, you know, thousands or tens of thousands to fund their campaigns.
So there would be no Donald Trump, because he wouldn't be able to buy his way into the campaign.
No, he would go back to entertainment, so he would fit the category of the HuffPost.
That's where we like him. All right.
I know.
But to do this, you have to repeal Citizens United, right? That decision has got to be overturned.
You don't need to change Citizens United in order to create a system of citizen-funded elections. The voucher proposal, the Supreme Court's indicated a million times, would be completely constitutional. What you need to change in Citizens United is the super PAC. And my own view is the Supreme Court is primed to do that, and I think it would do that. And that's why there, if the Supreme Court doesn't, that's why there is a role to think about constitutional change in the future. But even without the super PAC, what we've got to do is create a system where it's not this tiny fraction of the 1% who are the dominant funders in these camps.
All right. Well, Larry Lessig, thank you for joining us.
We wish you luck on your journey.
Thank you.
Don't get killed by a dragon or whatever.
I'm trying hard. I've got my guards.
And we're back. I'm Arthur Delaney, joined in studio by Ryan Riley, Huffington Post reporter. And over the phone, we've got Wesley Lowery from the Washington Post. And on August 13th, 2014, Ryan Riley and Wesley Lowery were both arrested for being in a McDonald's, basically, in Ferguson. So to mark this anniversary, I guess the Ferguson... The St. Louis County Police Department has decided to, at the last minute of within a year-long statute of limitations, they've decided to press charges. And people have gone from outraged to amused that this is happening. And I thought we'd mark the occasion by going over an investigative report that accompanies the charging documents, which I'm not sure we've even seen yet in Ryan Riley's case.
Yeah, I've been fighting for this document for a very long time, so it's good to finally see it. I mean, that's one positive development out of this. And I think that, you know, outraged to amused is a good range of what I think Wesley and I have been feeling looking at this too. And also just sort of, you know, disappointed that it's a distraction.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
From, I think, the reporting that we would want to be doing there.
And both of you, Wesley Lowery, you guys are talking about this so publicly because you're completely fighting back against it.
Well, of course. I mean, I think we've been transparent from the very beginning about what happened in that restaurant and what happened in the moments after that restaurant. We've been very clear and extremely consistent for people who've talked very frequently, extremely consistent in our stories about what happened. There's some videotape of it. And so, yeah, I mean, we've been out here discussing this in part because it's so ridiculous. And also in part because, you know, for so long, they wouldn't give us any police report. They wouldn't give us any information.
Now, they didn't even have a police report for this until April. And that's referenced in this investigative report, which is put together apparently even later than April. And bear in mind, that is more than half a year after this actually happened last August. This happened in the wake of the police killing of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson. And this was the beginning of a massive period of arrest that has really been, become this protest movement known as Black Lives Matter. And the investigative report that they put together takes pains to provide this context. And I think they go above and beyond. And since Wesley Lowery has not yet obtained a copy of this, I'll read it to you. They're talking about a level of violence that's interfering with their abilities to answer calls. And it says, Incident Command was also aware of the presence of the new Black Panther Party since August 10th, 2014. Incident Command was additionally aware that anarchists and communists from such groups as the Revolutionary Communist Party were either present or had indicated their intention to come to Ferguson with the stated intention in participating in the civil unrest.
I mean, this sounds like an FBI file from the 1960s. I mean, this is what
It sounds like Wesley Lowery's Twitter trolls. What do you make of that, Wesley Lowery?
Well, exactly. I mean, what we know about both the Revolutionary Communist Party and the New Black Panther Party is that they're both groups of like 15 people who sometimes show up places and wave signs and yell at cops. And I think the Revolutionary Communists put out their own like newspaper too. I mean, this isn't like ISIS had declared it was showing up. these are a bunch of like unemployed people, you know, who are trying to get media to write about them.
And here's the kicker on that, right? So a couple days after this incident, guess who police in charge at the time were working with to keep the march going in a peaceful manner? The new Black Panther Party.
Really? Now, the new Black Panther Party, in addition to however many members it has, it's a major right-wing meme, or at least it was for a while there.
Yeah, I can't seem to escape them. I've been covering them since.
Megyn Kelly on Fox News was constantly showing, this is video of the new Black Panther Party intimidating voters, and it was like a guy standing at a polling station.
Right.
Anyway, the report also takes pains to say the manager is instructed to close the business and asked for help doing so. And that may be dubious. What do you think, Wesley Lowery?
I mean, it seems highly unlikely what we know of the manager. At the end of the day, what seems more likely about in terms of the way the police were behaving during that period of time is they likely came in and said, listen, we're going to close your restaurant down. And the manager, Keith, who at this point, you know, pretty well personally, probably said, no, okay, whatever, guys. What we do know also is that McDonald's has been pretty clear at the corporate level from the very beginning that they did not request any help evacuating this building. They did not request anyone to be taken into custody. And so the idea that they're going to try to legally justify this by saying, because again, this is a police force essentially exercising a martial law, coming into a private establishment and detaining and arresting two paying customers in that private establishment. That's one of the reasons that those lines about the management requesting it are so important and so vital to their case. Unfortunately, they're just inaccurate.
So you're not guilty of trespassing if the people in charge of the place didn't want you to leave.
Yeah.
He certainly welcomed us back with open arms in the days after that.
And you guys went back there and had some fries, right?
I was there yesterday.
He's still declining Wes's selfie request, as far as I know. But he shook our hands and he talks to us and he jokes with us.
Why would anyone decline a selfie request? Now this document is really long and horribly written, but part that's repeated. And it's similar for both guys. It says, while attempting to help close the business, Officer McCann directed his attention to Mr. Riley, who was near the back corner of the restaurant. He advised Mr. Riley he would have to leave rather than pack his belongings to leave. Mr. Riley simply moved his belongings around in an inefficacious manner. Officer McCann then packed Mr. Riley's bag for him in a further effort to assist him in leaving the restaurant. When it became apparent that Mr. Riley was not going to leave as directed, Officer McCann placed Mr. Riley under arrest. When Mr. Lowery began to put his bag down near the soda machine and stopped in order to video record, Officer Steinmetz placed Mr. Lowery under arrest for trespassing. Mr. Lowery, how does that narrative sound? Is anything left out of there, or is that basically what happened?
Well, what we know from the video that has been recorded was that as I packed, I asked a series of what I think were eminently reasonable questions. I asked, one, if the officers refrained from pointing his weapon at me.
Wait. He was pointing his gun at you?
Yeah, he was gesturing with his gun that I needed to hurry up.
And these
did not do that.
These officers are dressed in full combat gear.
Correct. Yeah, and so, I've got a notebook. And so I'm asking, maybe that wouldn't be the most civil way to get me to move more quickly. Because, in fact, that might be, in fact, increasing my anxiety about the situation. It might be impairing my ability to pack up. But that said, after that, I attempted to ask the officer, hey, officer, my car is in this lot. Does it matter what door I need to go out? Am I going to be able to drive out of the lot, or should I just walk up the street? We're being evacuated. We're told a riot is breaking out. And so I thought, I should probably reasonably ask, should I just run away? What are you trying to tell me? Should I just leave and on foot? Am I going to be able to get in my car? At the time, he told me he didn't have time for questions. And then a few seconds later, decided, well, of course you can get your car. And so he was a little contradictory. Then we got to, as I, picked up my things, I packed my bag, and I'm walking towards the door, and I confronted another officer who decided that I couldn't go out the door I'd been instructed to. I needed to turn around and go out another one. So I stopped and said, all right, guys, I'm going to need you to tell me which one to go out of. And as they conferred, my bag started to slip. And what we know from the video is that, you know, I said, hey, officers, can I please just adjust my bag real quick? And at that point, they decided, you know, enough had been enough, that they, you know, that politeness was just a step too far. And they were going to take me into custody.
So they think you were basically lollygagging with the bag there.
I mean,
this is all in response to recording. I think was the issue here, which, you know, luckily Wes's video went through, because I can't imagine what narrative we would be seeing in this report had that that video not been here. It would, especially when you're interviewing officers about something they did wrong months and months and months and months later. That's a lot of time to create a narrative.
So. Now you both have said they slammed you. That
yes.
This was a rough arrest.
Right. When they initially took me into custody, they used, you know, force. They jammed a finger into basically my neck and said, stop resisting, stop resisting, stop resisting. And I said, I'm not resisting, I'm not resisting, I'm not resisting. I went, you know, I put my hands behind my back. I did everything.
It says he put his thumb in your mandible.
Yes. Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then, you know, what's under dispute, according to the officer, is that on the way out the door, so he slams my head into the door and then sarcastically apologizes for it. Now, what's interesting about that is, right, like, this was, you know, enough of a story, the fact that they arrested journalists. And I immediately after that, you know, when we were waiting out on the street, asked repeatedly for that officer's name after he slammed my head on the door. And he was silent, and every single one of the people around
Officer
him
was McCann.
Silent. Officer McCann, who we now learned his name, who, as it turns out, has a, you know, the man that they put in charge of protecting property on Ferguson, it turns out, allegedly crashed his police car into private property and destroyed it and then fled the scene without reporting it.
So that's a little bit of oppo on Officer McCann.
Allegedly. He was suspended from the same.
Now, they say you weren't providing identification, Ryan Reilly. What's that about?
Right. So here's my thoughts on this. I was out in the street there, and I'm documenting this incredible, incredible overreaction and sort of, I think, abuse of the people who are living there and were trying to exercise their First Amendment rights. And I think that he very clearly, as actually is clear in the report, he knew I was a reporter. I mean, I was sitting there with a couple of laptops. It doesn't take that much, you know, sense to sort of imagine that I'm a reporter. And so after I took photos, he came over and said, you took some photos of it. Let me see some ID. And I said, I asked if he had probable cause that I committed a crime, because I didn't, you know, that was, I didn't think I needed to show ID. I didn't need to show ID. Just because I'm a journalist doesn't give me a privilege to take photos over other people. Everyone's allowed to take photos of the police. There was nothing I did wrong. He had no reason to detain me or stop me or ask me for my identification. So I declined to provide it.
Wesley Lowery, they slammed you into a soda machine, you've said. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, of course. And so, like I said, he's picking up where we left off. I said, you know, can I please adjust my bag? They said, okay, let's take him. Two officers came at me, grabbed me with both hands and kind of throwing me up against the soda machine. My phone at that point drops out of my hand. Some Coke starts splashing on my shoulder. And, you know, at that point, they also tell me, you know, stop resisting. And I said, I'm not resisting. My hands are behind my back. And they kept instructing me that I was resisting arrest. It wasn't completely pleasant. It wasn't as violent as seemingly as deliberate as Ryan's kind of assault a few minutes later, but it was certainly unnecessarily aggressive. It was not that I was going to pull away or try to run from them. You know, the moment they decided they were going to arrest me, I turned around and put my hands behind my back.
But they're rough with two guys who they know to be, or in all likelihood knew, were journalists.
Well, they certainly knew I was a journalist. I mean, I was wearing identification and had told them that.
And so, in the documents, he said, the officer who arrested me said that he believed I was a journalist.
So this is a distorted picture on the one hand, because they realize there will be some scrutiny of this. You can just imagine goes down for people who are not journalists,
right? But here's what I think. I think the culture of the department that they're in, maybe they didn't actually believe that. Maybe they didn't believe that there was going to be any, and I mean, probably rightfully so.
Because the subsequent Justice Department investigation revealed their habits of abusing people constantly.
Well, that was the Ferguson Police Department, but I think just the culture of law enforcement in the area in general is very problematic.
Now, bear with me. Two last things. Mr. Reilly, in a Twitter posting to his account, indicated he had indeed spoken with the officers and been given the opportunity to identify himself. And it quotes this tweet SWAT just invaded McDonald's where I'm working. A copy of this tweet was seized as evidence by Detective Menzenworth. It was marked, packaged, and remanded to Detective Wolf to be conveyed to the evidence locker of the 7th Precinct. It's just incredibly bizarre.
Yeah.
So there's like your tweets have been physically taken.
Yeah. Forfeited. Yeah.
And then the report concludes, it details all the people they had arrested from the new Black Panthers. And so that's it, guys. I really hope that you two have been accused of trespassing, and I hope you can beat the charges. And Ryan Riley, I hope you get your tweets back.
I hope so too.
All those seized tweets will hopefully be returned.
Wesley Lowery, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this fateful day 1 year ago.
And we're back. We are joined once again by Arthur Delaney and Julia Craven. Guys, thanks for being here.
Yes.
You're welcome.
So we're going to talk about probably my favorite thing to talk about now over the last 3 months or so. It's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Donald Trump has had an amazing week, an absolutely amazing week.
Probably his best week yet.
And despite being more awful than he has been to date, which is an impressive feat for a guy who launched his campaign by calling immigrants from Mexico rapists and criminals.
He got in a fight with Fox News. He was wrong, and Fox was right, and Donald Trump won. Fox News buckled.
Okay, I cannot believe that we have to say this on this podcast. Fox News was totally in the right. They had done good journalism.
They did nothing wrong.
They asked, and what we're referring to is they asked hard questions of Trump at the Republican debate. Fox anchor Megyn Kelly said, "Why are you such a jerk to women all the time?" And Trump proceeded to whine and threaten Fox News until Roger Ailes called him up, and they apparently struck a truce. And Megyn Kelly went on TV after that and said, "I'm moving on." And then what did he do?
He also said that, like, oh, well, you know, she must have been on her period. And I'm just like, I feel some type of way because I don't like defending, like, certain people. And Megyn Kelly is one of them.
Right.
And I'm just like, oh, so great. Like, Megyn Kelly actually didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Megyn Kelly's interesting because Trump has been so terrible to her that it's turned her into this sort of innocent, portrait of excellence in journalism. And it makes people forget, I think, some of her journalistic past, which includes talking, I think, way overhyping these stories a few years ago about, like, the new Black Panthers and how they're going to intimidate you at the polls.
And Jesus was white, and which geographically just doesn't make any sense, but whatever.
I saw a picture of Jesus, and he was white, though.
Yeah, I did, too, but that doesn't mean it was accurate.
She also did that great thing, in addition to Jesus being white, imaginary people are white. For you parents here, you got to take the kids out of the room here. We're gonna give it away. Santa Claus, not real. And Megyn Kelly had that thing, right? It was like a year ago.
Yeah.
She said that Santa's white, so deal with it.
Right, and it's just like Santa Claus is an imaginary character, so why can't he be black?
What's like, wrong? What?
So Donald Trump made her look totally reasonable and wonderful. She actually she stood up for herself as a woman a lot of times in her career, including against Eric Erickson,
awful sexist,
who also Donald Trump is making him look incredibly reasonable, too. And in fact, when Fox News and Megyn Kelly said, never mind, we don't want to fight with Trump anymore, Eric Erickson looked even more reasonable still.
And this is Eric Erickson who, when Wendy Davis, state senator from Texas, was running for governor, ran a terrible campaign, but when she was running for governor, Eric Erickson's just standard way of referring to her was abortion Barbie.
He called Michelle Obama a Marxist harpy.
Fuck.
What? So anyway,
but those are the nice guys in this one, and they're the good guys in this fight. The bad guy in this fight is a billionaire real estate mogul from New York who is currently destroying all of the other Republican candidates in the polls for the Republican nomination, named Donald Trump.
Now, when I first it dawned on me that Eric Erickson was the protagonist in this situation, my first thought was, this really shows you that this moment is not durable. This is untenable. This is fleeting. But that's been true of everything that's gone Trump's way. And now I question, I thought we'd be watching the Trump flame out by this time, and we're not. So I'm not sure how long it's going on. I do believe it will happen and that he will not be the nominee. But it's become less certain how the eventual and certain demise of the Trump campaign will come about.
Well, I have a theory on that. Me and my friend, she asked me why Trump was leading in the polls. And I told her that it's the Kanye effect. It's like he's saying things that I think we can fairly say that a lot of Republican supporters want to say, but they're too scared to say it, or, you know, they have jobs or they're billionaires too or something like that. And so he gets up here and he says all of this outrageous stuff that some people are actually thinking.
Yeah.
And then they're just like, I like this guy. Vote, 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 vote.
I think you're right. And, yeah. And your friend and you are right. And
although Kanye West and Donald Trump, hearing them in the same sentence is kind of making my head just
spin a little
bit.
I'm feeling,
I'm getting nauseous.
Kanye is great, by the way.
It's just the confusion. You've got to admit, Kanye is a big jerk. His persona of yelling at people.
But he's not racist.
No. And a lot of times when he's being a jerk, he has a point and he's right.
Exactly.
So it's like his tone and the confronting people on stage at the Grammys or whatever is like not a very nice thing to do. But
top 10 moments in the past.
Here's a reason that Trump has an opening to be successful in this way. It is the political consultant class that makes itself rich off every campaign by telling these candidates, you hire us, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure you have exactly the message that will resonate with exactly the right demographic and donors. And they all get on stage with these meticulously crafted game plans to win the debate. And it's totally tedious and awful. And there's one blowhard who destroys them all just by saying these jackass things that people themselves want to say. So I think the weakness and the finger in the air sensibility of the other candidates really makes it easy for Trump to just burn everything down.
I mean, how many different Iraq war positions have we had from Jeb Bush so far this campaign? Nobody believes any of the things that he says about the Iraq war, right? It's just no one takes him seriously. And the Republican base is not like the donor class, right? The donor class is obsessed with the Iraq war because a lot of them have been like serious neoconservatives ideologically for a long time. The Republican base just watches Fox News and is mad at Obama for making us look weak. They don't really have a whole lot emotionally invested in. And, you know, whether 2003 was the breaking point for ISIS or 2014, or the breakout point.
And speaking of ISIS, Donald Trump just says, oh, we're going to take the oil and kick their butt.
Yeah.
and then China.
Sounds good to me.
Right. You just blow past the nuance of, well, my brother launched the Iraq war and it was terrible, but there was a surge and we could have.
We're going to beat him. We're going to beat him.
Yeah. And then China devalues its currency, which is complicated. That happened this week.
Yeah,
right.
And that is a particularly interesting point because while Trump's trade platform has been pitched in, I think, the most racist way he could possibly do it, in a way that makes it sort of seem in line with his very racist immigration policy, he has a point about how the United States has conducted its trade deals over the last two or three decades.
We're not beating them.
We're not beating them. And manufacturing
Make
jobs in the United States
great again.
Have gone to other places. And one of the ways that the United States has been losing is by having the dollar be overvalued, be too strong relative to other currencies. And so China basically is this week devalued their currency multiple times.
Because their stock market has been plunging and they can't figure – they tried all these other interventions that didn't work.
Right. And China's been trying not to devalue their currency for the last couple of years. They don't want to look like they have to depend on devaluing their currency in order to function as an economy. But even if they hit the growth rate they want to hit of 7% this year, which is a very high growth rate it will be their slowest growth in a long period of time. And China has so many people in poverty that if they don't grow at a very, very high rate, the potential for political unrest in China is very, very high.
So what does Trump do?
So Trump doesn't have to do anything. He can just say, look, China, they're devaluing their currency. They're killing us. I'm not going to let that happen. And Barack Obama's trade agenda, which is totally dependent on making allies with all these other countries who peg their currencies to the Chinese currency, that's totally fucked. It's completely fucked if China significantly devalues its currency. The whole legacy that Obama wants to have with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that is gone. So Obama's fucked, and Trump can say, look, Obama sucks. He's negotiating these crappy trade deals that are sending our jobs to China. And he'll kind of be right.
Donald Trump is even better at having an exclamation point in his campaign slogan. Jeb, it just says, Jeb,
yeah.
With a little exclamation point. And Donald Trump is, make America great again. Boom. Beat him.
Even if it was just his last name with an exclamation point, I mean, it's just like, Trump!
Trump! Like,
white men can Trump.
Wow.
That was a good one.
Okay, well, speaking of race, didn't Trump say some other stuff this week, Julia?
Yeah.
All right, let's set this up. Donald Trump, he'll beat the Chinese. The Mexicans are rapists. And if Black Lives Matter protesters came up to my podium like they did to Bernie Sanders, I'll punch them. Right?
Essentially. Or, he was just like, I will fight them. And I'm just like, what? Like, what do you mean you'll fight them?
Well, but so Bernie Sanders has had a couple speeches actually shut down by Black Lives Matter protests.
Just one speech, yeah.
And he was heckled. Oh, no,
like we were saying in the prior segment, he was heckled to the point where his speech was shut down. And Donald Trump is saying, hey, if that was me, I wouldn't let these, you know, angry black people have a microphone and talk. I would punch them.
And it's perfect for him. There's no constituency he can't offend and then win, apparently.
So that's the thing.
Well,
what do you think?
He's not going to get the black vote. I think it's safe to say that.
He said the blacks love me.
What?
Yeah. Well, of course he said that.
He's delusional.
Let's start making predictions on this, because most people have said that he shouldn't have been in it this far. Julie, what's your prediction on when he drops out, if at all?
I don't think he's going to get the nomination, but I wouldn't be super shocked if he did.
I can't imagine him dropping out before some actual primaries.
I think
some states are going to have to be won and lost before there's a big enough change in the dynamic.
He's clearly he's easily the most charismatic candidate, as Arthur pointed out, in the field. I mean, it's dawning on people, this is like he's actually running. This is
because
he doesn't have
consultants massaging his every syllable.
And yet he is going to be in this for a long time, which is great for the Huffington Post making money off of Donald Trump. So thanks for joining us, guys.
The Huffington Post entertainment section, that is.
No politics.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Adriana Yucero, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta. I'm Zach Carter, and this week we were joined by Huffington Post reporters Arthur Delaney, Julia Craven, and Ryan Riley. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening. We miss you already.